back session number 12564, reel 3.
Mr. Grove, reel 3. Now, if we can pick up the chronology, you were talking about being at Ouistreham and being in action against the Germans in Kong. Can you say anything more in detail about the work that you did against Kong?
Against Kong, I was a GPOAC who went forward to an observation post and directed the gun from behind. Normally there were four of us in an observation post. That would be the GPO, the GPOAC, and two signallers. And you would be observing and correcting the fire of the gun, which was firing from behind you.
You were the GPOAC?
I was the GPOAC, yeah.
How dangerous was it in that position?
Not particularly. Obviously, there was some risk that you could be spotted, but generally speaking, you chose your position with care.
Was there much incoming fire from the German guns?
Not really, no. I think they were, at that stage, were getting more to the situation of self-preservation. And as you would have seen from the pictures of Kahn, Kahn was virtually a heap of rubble at that stage.
What was the feeling in the British artillery about the quality of the German artillery pieces and artillery firing?
I think a lot of us felt it was a haphazard. I mean, I had the situation that on the 10th of August in the night I was not on duty, I was flat on the ground, and we had a shell land about 15 yards from me. I'm extremely lucky because I took upon every day since the 10th of August 1944 as a bonus. Shell landed coming towards me, and I ended up with three minor injuries to the face and some damage to both legs. And yet, according to the man that picked me up, and I'm still in touch with him, there was a hole as big as my hand, less than a foot to my right. And my kit bag, which was near me, has literally 100 holes in it.
Where was this? Whereabouts in Normandy?
This was Grey Sur Mer.
Where?
Grey Sur Mer.
How do you spell it?
Gray Sur Mer.
Where is Grey Sur Mer?
It's part of the original landing beach. We were still tied down in the immediate area. It's still south of Kahn.
What did you feel as the shell exploded?
I can't remember anything of the incident as such. I was certainly frightened because there was blood all over the place, and when you've got blood running all over your face, you are concerned, however slight the thing was. I was taken into Bayeux, you know, the place where the tapestry comes from, where there was a general hospital. And all I can remember from that was these very young nurses, who were staff nurses, who had the rank of lieutenant, and the matron of the hospital, who was grey and had rows and rows of medals. And why on earth the medal ribbon should have impressed me in that state, I don't know, but she obviously had been around in the army for a long time. I was there for 3 weeks.
Was this a tented hospital?
Yeah, a tented hospital.
What did you think of the treatment that you got there?
Marvellous. I cannot complain in any way at all. I have far more regard for the staff than I have for the patients. There are a number of patients who seem to think that everybody ought to be attending to them. And that, I think, was dreadful.
Were the patients of all nationalities?
Yes, we had 3 Germans in, 2 of whom had gangrene.
Were they treated in just the same way?
Oh, yes. One's got to say, in all fairness, that the nurses treated everybody as a patient according to their need as a patient. And it was the people with the less important wounds who seemed to object to the nurses attending to the Germans in those circumstances. And I always feel that was regrettable.
So did they voice their opinions?
Oh, yes.
Were there any facilities or equipments lacking for your treatment in the way of bandages or drugs or anaesthetics?
Not really, because at that stage, don't forget, penicillin wasn't with us. They'd only just bought in the sulfanilamide drugs. And looking back on it, I don't know how many hundreds of tablets I must have taken over those 3 weeks to prevent infection at the end of the day.
These were sulfonamide tablets?
They had 3 types of tablets. And I had all 3 in the course of the 3 weeks. Looking back on it, I must have taken about 60 tablets in 3 or 4 days.
What was your feeling about getting back into the action?
I was rather anxious that I shouldn't get to the state of affairs where they would say, all right, well, he's finished with that regiment and put me to somewhere else. And I was rather glad when I got back to my own colleagues.
Why was it so important to you not to be transferred to another unit?
I think having been with that unit for 3.5, 4 years, there had been a camaraderie built up which you wanted to maintain. You had made friends, and it would be nice to be back among friends.
And did you get back to your unit?
Yes, and to the same one as I was in. That I was transferred to after my arrival in France.
By this time they must have been advancing rapidly across Europe.
They started to move across Europe. We moved from there up to Le Havre and then on to Dieppe.
What happened at Le Havre?
Le Havre was where we were used as a field regiment. And we used all 4 guns from our to fire on a particular spot in Le Havre. We were there for the night prior to the Gibson raid. There was a Gibson raid on Le Havre when Gibson flew backwards and forwards and directed everybody into bombing. But that was on the dawn, and during the night we had been softening up Le Havre so that there was a minimum of resistance, because it was a pocket on the end of a peninsula, which meant that there was this pocket of Germans behind the fighting, and they obviously wanted to get it out of the way.
What did the air attack on Le Havre look like?
Quite remarkable. Nobody made any spectacular dives or anything of that sort. They flew in steadily over, and the amount of anti-aircraft fire was minimal, because by that time the anti-aircraft sites had been put out of action by our shelling during the night.
How long do you think you were in action at Le Havre?
Oh, overall, I would say about 3 hours.
Did you go into the town?
No, no. We moved on from then up to Dieppe, where we were stationed on an anti-aircraft site adjacent to a prisoner of war camp. And the prisoner of war camp, I believe, was intended to hold 10,000 and had something like, I think it was 15,000 in it. You know, at that stage, the Germans were surrendering in quite large numbers, and trying to cope with this situation was quite something. One of the things I remember about Dieppe was that was when we sort of started to get rather confident about the war and the fact that we were going to win, and things that we were required to scrub our webbing and polish the brass and that sort of thing to bring the webbing up to sort of drill standards, ready for the occupation force.
Did you see anything of the German POWs?
Oh, yes. We saw plenty of them. But security was a bit of a problem. And whilst this might be considered hearsay in some respects, there was a couple of SS officers who had been, and they used the Moroccans, who were never sure which side they were on, in fact, to guard these two SS officers.
Guard them separately?
And they were kept in a compound. And the Moroccans were provided with extra food to sort of keep them interested.
How were the German POWs being treated?
Not well, but one's got to say that it was an odd circumstance. Here you were with provision for 10,000, and you've got half as many again on the area, and not knowing quite what to do with them. So I don't think they were deliberately badly treated, but at the same time I do think that there was a strain on resources, I think would be the answer.
Why do you say they were not being treated well?
They were in the open. They were not able to be covered. Sanitary facilities were at a minimum. But what does one do in those circumstances? I mean, none of us were particularly comfortable at that stage.
So were they digging holes in the ground?
They would, well, for the latrines and that sort of thing, yeah.
For shelter?
No, they just sat there looking thoroughly demoralised, I think would be the answer.
What was the weather like?
Not bad at that stage. You were still talking in terms of the autumn rather than the winter.
This would have been September?
Yes.
Were they getting fed and watered?
Oh yes, they were receiving rations. Whether it was adequate or not is something I couldn't possibly express an opinion on. But, I mean, obviously the people that were in charge of them had to use what resources they'd got as evenly as possible among a rather large number.
Did you speak to any of the POWs?
No.
Can you describe the actual fighting at Dieppe that you took part in?
I didn't. There wasn't any fighting at Dieppe. No, but it did. By then, the battle had moved on, and we'd stopped at that stage. We moved on from there up to the outskirts of Brussels, to Alst.
How much contact with the French civilian population did you have?
I was entertained by some of them. They were very pleased to see us. I think they had resigned themselves to some extent to being an occupied force for a very long time, and they were relieved that it did not prove to be so. There were those that were very pro-Allies, and there were those that were very pro-Germans. We've got this situation that you'd had German garrisons around, and by natural by natural society, if you like, there were German girls, well, there were French girls who got rather attached to German young men, and to suddenly sort of find that the situation was reversed and they were now their enemies must have been a strain.
Did some of the French make their pro-German feelings felt to you?
Very few, but there were one or two, yes.
Who were hostile to you?
They were hostile to the fact that their cozy relationship with the Germans had been disturbed. But they were the people, I think, that had probably having quite a good time with the Germans there.
How did they make their feelings known to you?
By lack of cooperation, to a large extent, I think you would say.
How did the others entertain you? Took you into their homes?
They'd produce the odd bottle of Calvados and that sort of thing and offer you a drink. And cider, of course, was the drink out there. But one had to be very careful about that to make sure it was proper cider and not one of the hooches that they produced.
How had living conditions been in Normandy and France? Because some people speak of trials like mosquitoes and so on.
Coming up through Caen, you've got to realise that in June, the harvest was in the fields and it was rotting. And therefore you had this very almost ideal climate for mosquitoes. And the mosquito bites were very uncomfortable indeed, no question about that. And the mosquitoes were quite large. You tried to work out some system by which you could have a reasonably mosquito-free place to have a sleep. For instance, in a slit trench, you could cover it with a ground sheet or something like that and use a stick of cordite so you got the smoke, which cleared it. And then you could sleep there for the night quite reasonably comfortably.
Did you see much of the suffering of farm animals there?
Oh, yes. This was one of the unfortunate things. There were large numbers of farm animals, particularly horses, that had been killed in the course of the action and were lying around. And I don't know whether you know anything about horses, but when they die like that, they swell up. And if they burst, you get this pungent smell which pervades the area for miles around. And there was this problem that not only the horses, but even some of the German, the local horses, there was some of the German traffic was still using horse-drawn vehicles.
Now, you said that you went up through Belgium. Was the attitude of the Belgian population any different from the French?
Oh, they were very friendly, even to the point that we were stationed outside a village, and another sergeant and myself, they insisted upon us sleeping on their beds, whilst they were quite prepared to go and sleep on cushions in the lounge.
Where was this?
That was in Alst, A-double-A-L-S-T.
Did you take advantage of the offer?
Oh, yes. If you hadn't, they would have been offended. They were those. This family that I'm thinking of consisted of a husband who looked very ill indeed, and a wife who, whilst looking 50 plus, was in fact less than 30, and three children. And they were very good to us indeed. We didn't allow them to provide us with food, but we produced our own food for them to cook for us and that sort of thing, so that they could make a contribution. And this was absolutely essential with these people. And then a few, we'd been there a couple of weeks when they had a confirmation. They're Roman Catholics, of course, in that area. And they had a confirmation. And they have a fair in the middle of the in the town square, with a fun fair and roundabouts and that sort of thing. And we were invited to take part in the festivities.
Did the Belgians say anything about the way in which they lived in under German occupation?
No. I think these were people who really wanted to try and forget what they'd gone through, and were making them, they had been liberated, and this was the thing that was uppermost in their minds. I think they were harder on their collaborators than possibly the Frenchmen were.
What did you see of that?
I didn't see a lot of it, but you could always spot the collaborators because they'd shave their hair off. And, you know, whilst today we accept these people that walk around without any hair, it was unusual in those days. And girls had their hair shaved off, and they were quite hard on anybody that was thought to have collaborated with the Germans.
What's happened to men who have been collaborating?
I don't know. We didn't see many of them, because don't forget, by that stage, the majority of men who were not fit for military service, to which they were pressed into, had been taken off to use in factories, and there weren't many men in the villages of their origin at that stage.
So, did you go up through Brussels and Antwerp?
Yes. I went through Brussels, and then we went up to Antwerp, and we were part of a thing called Antwerp X. Antwerp X was an anti-aircraft unit formed by the Americans, and included three rings, in effect, round Antwerp to deal with the B-1s, because Antwerp had more B-1s than London, and Antwerp really isn't much bigger than a local town like Wimbledon.
What kind of guns did you have to defend Antwerp?
3.7 mobiles.
So it was still really the same HSE unit?
Oh yes, it was still. We were, the 86th Regiment was part of Antwerp X.
Can you describe the work that you did against the V1s?
Yeah, we had a constant watch. The V1 was very visible because it had this flame that came from the back of the engine. And anti-aircraft is based on the ideal target. And the ideal target is a constant speed, constant height. And, of course, the V1 was constant speed, constant height. It was a rocket-propelled plane, like a small plane. And, therefore, there was quite a bit of success with anti-aircraft fire against the V1, no question about it. And the big snag was, of course, that if it got caught on the outer ring, there was always the danger it was going to fall somewhere in the inner ring, because we were 10 miles from Antwerp, I suppose, most of the time.
Which ring were you in?
We were in the inner ring. The Americans had the outer ring, we had the inner ring. And the AK-AK gun was a satisfactory deterrent of B-1s. They were quite effective.
How many do you think you shot down?
I haven't any idea, but the percentage figure is quite high. Oh, yes.
Scores?
No, that I wouldn't go that far. But for the number engaged, there was quite a few that were put out of action before they got to their destination.
Would they come over at regular times of the day or irregularly?
Irregularly. And, of course, at the same time, starting it was the V2, which was another kettle of fish, because all you got of that was you suddenly saw a wisp of smoke in the vertical smoke, where they'd opened up their, what do they call the thing, silo. They'd opened up their silo, and it had fired their rocket and closed their silo again. So it was very difficult to trace them. The only way you could do it was by taking accurate bearings on the smoke pail and then going and looking for the intersection, which I think the RAF did. We didn't. We couldn't do any, obviously, because they were behind the line. I mean, there seems to be little doubt now, as you read history, that it had been his intention to use the V1s to prevent Antwerp being a satisfactory port. He didn't achieve it.
So the V2s were being launched in the Netherlands.
That's right.
But you could see the launching.
You could see something of the launching. Yeah.
But once it had been launched, could you see anything of the V2?
No, because the only time you see a rocket if you fire it, even on firework day, is either at the beginning or the end. You don't see anything of its route.
Were the V2s landing in the Antwerp area as well?
Some of them, not many, because they were being directed to southeast England, in effect.
Whereabouts was your air site in the inner ring?
I can't remember, honestly. I know I should do, but there was... I would say that we were somewhere between Antwerp and the Dutch border.
To the north of Antwerp?
North of Antwerp, yeah.
Were you near a built-up area?
No. We were in an area which was pine trees.
Were you near the River Scheldt?
No, I don't think so.
How long were you doing this kind of work for? Against the V1s?
It was after the Ardennes, wasn't it? The Ardennes was...
That started in December.
December 44.
And went on into January.
That's right. And then I would say we must have moved into that area in the January. Round to about the end of April.
So you didn't start the defence against the V1s until after Christmas?
That's right.
How did you like doing that work?
It was nice to have a